we have to be very frank with each other and be honest and say, actually, racism does exist in Scotland. We can't shy away from it.
That was Anam Kaiser-Javid, the SNP MP for Airdrie and Shotts, and we'll hear more from them later in the show. Hello, and welcome to The Stooshy, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson Media that helps you be better briefed. I'm Paul Malik, and on this episode I'll be joined by Andy Phillip and Rachel Amory to examine and explain the last week in Scottish politics. But first, a summary of the week's biggest national and international politics stories, read by Chris Finn.
First Minister Nicola Sturgeon announced lockdown rules would be dropped to their lowest level since the pandemic started earlier this week. Life will almost be back to normal in Scotland as of Monday, August the 9th, when remaining restrictions on social gatherings and physical distancing are eased. The majority of COVID-19 restrictions have been lifted from the UK's four countries, but certain safeguards still remain, including wearing face masks in public and contact tracing of positive cases. 16 and 17-year-olds in Scotland are to be offered the first dose of a coronavirus vaccine as soon as possible, it was also announced. More than 10,000 people have now made the life-threatening journey across the English Channel in small boats this year. Crossings in 2021, which already eclipsed last year's annual total last month, have resumed in recent days following a period of bad weather. Despite this, the UK continues to see far fewer boat arrivals and asylum claims than many of its European counterparts. Bella Sankey, Director of Charity Detention Action, said, "Overall, asylum applications are dropping and much lower than they were in the 2000s, but the number of high channel crossings shows that desperate people trying to save their lives will risk everything to reach safety." US President Joe Biden has told New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to resign after an investigation found he sexually harassed nearly a dozen women. President Biden was drawn to comment on the issue after a defiant Cuomo disputed the facts uncovered in a report that concluded 11 women who said that Cuomo had touched them inappropriately, commented on their appearance, or made suggestive comments about their sex lives were telling the truth. The 63-year-old governor, who just a year ago was widely hailed for his steady leadership during the darkest days of the COVID crisis, even writing a book about it, refuses to stand down.
Thank you, Chris. I'm glad to say that we are back once again following a short, brief period of respite and recuperation over the holidays, and it's fair to say that Scottish politics hasn't let us down, because this week has been another cracker. It all kicked off on Monday after the Health Secretary Hamza Yousaf and his wife were forced to lodge a complaint to the Care Inspectorate after they alleged a nursery that they were trying to get their child into in Broughty Ferry, of all places, had discriminated against them because of the child and their surnames. And Rachel, you spoke with Hamza Yousaf's wife, Nadia Al-Nakla, and she had quite a bit to say about racism in general in Scotland and the pretty awful experience that they've gone through over the last few weeks.
Yeah, the past week's been quite difficult for the whole family, I think. They've received an absolute barrage of abuse on social media. Nadia said that she was left in tears reading the comments that have been left on Facebook and Twitter. We ourselves needed to actually disable the comments completely on our Facebook pages just because of the amount of abuse that was being posted there. A lot of the comments were saying things such as, they're playing the race card, there are two sides to the story, they shouldn't have gone to the media with this, things like that. And Miss Al-Nakla says this shows the underbelly of racism that exists in Scotland. And she said it was the victim blaming at the highest level. She also said people who had maybe not experienced racial discrimination before were telling her and her family how they should be dealing with this situation. I think she found that particularly frustrating. I spoke to the Health Secretary this week as well, and he said that he does receive racial abuse quite frequently, but says because his wife is not in the public eye so much, she found this week very hard to deal with. I think especially because this was all about her little daughter, it does touch more nerves when it's about your children as well. And I think as well, it's been particularly hard because this is a nursery in Broughty Ferry, which is where she was brought up. It's where she lives. So these people who are leaving these comments are her neighbours. She could very well be walking past her in the street for all she knows. I think knowing it's her own community as well has been quite difficult for her. And as much as Mr. Yousaf said that this is something he's more used to, it really shouldn't be that way either. No one should have to put up with this racist abuse. They were telling me in the past that they've received threats to firebomb their house, threats to burn their children. when they posted a picture on Twitter of their daughter's baby box arriving, they said people on Twitter said that she deserved to be drowned. I think we can all agree that these are absolutely horrendous threats to making, and it really does need to be called out quite publicly. And I think many people in Scotland maybe don't want to face up to the difficult fact that Scotland does have a problem with racism. And I think the events of last year and of the past week in particular really demonstrates that.
I mean, I think that's right, isn't it? It's not. It shouldn't even be controversial to say that Scotland still has problems with race and the way we deal with it. And I think that the example that you've quoted with Mr. Youssef's family being subjected to that and victim blaming, and I think that's quite telling, really, of where we are as a country. That, you know, your first suspicion isn't to just assume that the person who's been racially abused or racially discriminated against is telling the truth, but to assume that they've got an agenda or some sort of secret mission. I mean, it comes down to a lot of things, Andy, and I think it's fair to say as well, when it comes to representation of minorities, Scotland still has a lot more to do. I mean, I think we're almost an example, aren't we? Where I was a full disclosure, I have been adopted by a Pakistani family. That's why my surname is Malik, but I've never had any sort of racial discrimination. Fortunately, I know that many of my family have, and it's dreadful. And it's amazing when they tell me about it, how used to it they are of these scenarios, just these little sort of bits of discrimination that live every day. I think the time probably has come, Andy, isn't it, where rather than sort of tell people how they should be feeling, is that we should be listening to people from ethnic minorities, backgrounds, and people of colour when they tell us that, and rather than rushing to protect the other sides or query what they are, to just be quiet and just listen to what they have to say. Would you agree with that?
I would, yeah. And I think one of the problems that you find in Scotland, it's not unique to Scotland, this problem, but there is a difficult stage where people have to sort of admit that there's problems. It's very difficult to do that. And there's a kind of tendency which is amplified on social media in particular, where there's an element of exceptionalism, whereas, you know, Scotland does like to portray itself as this amazingly tolerant, liberal democracy, and in many respects that's absolutely correct, but often you know, Scotland doesn't quite live up to the image that we all like to portray, and the test is on those moments where we hear loud complaints about this, is, you know, from any sector of any section of society which feels that they're being discriminated against or not being listened to. The key test is to prove that you are listening and then to do something about it. I mean, you just have to look back across maybe devolution from the beginning. There was a large focus on bigotry, more to do with religious sectarian hatred. You know, the job is not done there by any stretch of the imagination. But the point about actually listening and accepting that there might be a problem and not just brushing under the carpet and getting angry on social media, that's the test there.
Now, earlier in the week, Group Head of Politics David McDougall caught up with Airdrie and Short SNP Anam Kaiser Javid, where he discussed what the transition was like going from being a modern studies teacher to a member of parliament.
It was pretty abrupt, and, you know, obviously as a modern studies teacher, I didn't talk really about my political affiliations in the classroom, and I hadn't told my pupils at this point that I was selected as a candidate. And I went into class one day, and it was in my higher class, and one of my pupils, let's just call him Bob for argument's sake, Bob turned around to me, put his hand up, and he's like, "Mrs. Javid." Like, yep, assuming that he's going to ask me a specific question about inequality in China, which we were looking at. He turned around, he's like, "Mrs. Javid, Ian Blackford tweeted something about you last week." what's that all about? And I was like, okay, so this is the conversation that I'm going to have now. And I'd actually spoken to my head of department and head teacher before that, and he'd said, you know, when it comes up, just tell the pupils and be honest about it. And so the career change has been quite abrupt. If I'm being honest though, David, I feel a little bit of guilt. And the guilt is that I was quite a strict teacher in terms of mannerisms in the classroom and not talking over one another. And I feel like I maybe gave my pupils into a lot more trouble than they should have in comparison to some of my colleagues on the benches in the chamber.
Well, I'm going to have to mind my P's and Q's today then, haven't I? I don't want to talk over you. Now you've got yourself in the House of Commons and there's all kinds of talking over there and bad manners. But let me take you back to that campaign trail. You were campaigning about the same time as the Scottish parliamentary elections were going on. So was that kind of odd overlap, because your by-election was right after the elections, the Holyrood elections. I saw lots of strange things about you on social media, that you were Hamza Yousaf's cousin was one of them, I think. What was the weirdest thing you read about yourself?
Oh, the weirdest thing I've read about myself is probably, that I'm related to Hamza or that I'm related to Anas. And it's really interesting. So prior to my time in the SNP, I was a member of the Labour Party. I was the General Secretary of Muslim Friends of Labour, and I actually interned for Anas. I think it was around 18 or 19 when I was a member of the Labour Party. So I've been called Anas's cousin, I've been called Hamza's cousin. The only person I've not been linked to in terms of relation is COCAB, who's obviously the MSP for Glasgow Kelvin. That was probably the weirdest thing that I read about myself.
And some of it is like fun, like amusing stuff like that. But we do see that women and people from minority backgrounds come in for a lot of abuse on social media. Has that happened to you, and how have you been dealing with it? We've seen it even this week, you know, with Hamza and his wife as well, with Nadia Nakla, talking about the racism that they've had online.
Yeah, so we have to be very frank with each other and be honest and say, actually, racism does exist in Scotland. We can't shy away from it. If people have a look at my Twitter, for example, they'll see very often there is racial abuse that is thrown at me. And I use my platform as the Member of Parliament for Adrian Shotts to demonstrate that, yes, I may be young, I may be a woman of colour, I may be a practicing Muslim, but actually, I'm very proud of all of that. And if people want to complain, they can complain. Very often as well, though, we find that it's Twitter trolls who are anonymous, that don't have a name linked to their account. And I actually raised this in the House of Commons. I had a question during business leader questions and directly asked Jacob Rees-Mogg, well, you know, we've seen the horrific abuse that the Black England players received. This is just some of the stuff that I've experienced. And so will the government give government time for debate on this very matter? And they turned around and said no. But, you know, I'm going to keep continuing to raise this, not just for myself, but actually for all those people who don't have a voice, whether they are from an ethnic minority group, if they are a person who practices a religion, or actually if they are someone who is gay, lesbian, from any minority group.
Getting a bit into politics, Parliament is on recess right now. What are your kind of own priorities in terms of legislation when you get back? So much has devolved to Holyrood. What areas do you think you get the chance to influence for Scotland from Westminster?
Yeah, so I mean, for me at Westminster, I'm really looking to push against the Tory agenda and demonstrate why Scotland needs her independence. So David, I've been elected for less than 100 days. And during that time, the Tories have voted for international aid cuts, and some really prominent backbenchers actually voted against them, like Theresa May and I think Jeremy Hunt. And they're also attempting to push through this really draconian bill that rejects international responsibility in tackling the refugee crisis. So I spoke at this debate, actually, and I think it was Eid. Yeah, it was Eid. It was really emotional listening to the speeches and speaking in this debate, and I referred to this NHS doctor. His name's Dr. Waheed, and he was a refugee who is now practicing as a doctor down in England and has saved lives during the pandemic. And I really do feel as if the pushes that the policies, sorry, that the Tories are pushing through really don't represent the views of Scotland. And to be frank, the Tories haven't won an election in Scotland in my lifetime. So I'll be looking to push against this. And really, the other kind of main ones as well would be, for example, immigration. And I called for immigration to be devolved in my maiden speech whilst we're not an independent country. And I really do have the view that what we need in Scotland is very much different to what the needs of England are in terms of the workforce. So the Scottish Government released a briefing paper a couple of years ago that stated that immigration was required to sustain the NHS, for example. And we've seen through this coronavirus pandemic, especially with social care staff, and I've been out and about in my constituency, actually. And one of the big issues, I was speaking to some factory owners last week, and one of the big issues they were saying were, yes, we've got the issues of Brexit in terms of the tariffs and importing, exporting things out of the UK into mainland Europe, but actually they've got a real lack of staff, and they've lost a lot of staff due to Brexit. Now, if immigration was devolved to Scotland, we could set policy that's reflective of what Scotland needs. And, you know, just to carry on the political chat. And that is really why, in the crux of why I support independence, not just for the sake of independence, but with independence, Scotland can set policy that's reflective of the needs of Scotland. And whilst I have my position as the Member of Parliament for Adrian Shotts, I'll be pushing against that, those Tory policies in Westminster, along with their austerity agenda that they're promoting.
Well, when it comes to independence, there are splits within the SNP in Holyrood or in Westminster. Those kind of pro-Nicola Sturgeon factions who are happy with the First Minister's timetable on independence and those looking for a faster timetable. Where do you sit on that subject?
So this is absolutely fascinating that you've asked me this, David, because I can put on my modern studies teacher hat, because we looked in higher politics at the SNP and the history of the SNP and the kind of fundamentalist route that want independence straight away, and the ones that are happy to kind of just carry on following the leader. And I just think it's really, really fascinating to watch, and now that I'm involved in it, it's even more interesting. I would definitely take the view that Nicola Sturgeon is our First Minister. She has put in an absolute power of work since the beginning of last year in terms of the coronavirus pandemic. And when we are going to go for an independence referendum, we need to have those real conversations, knock on the doorsteps and chat to people. And people have made a lot of sacrifices, and right now, as the First Minister has stated, is not the time. But once we're getting out of this pandemic, once it's safe to do so, I really look forward to campaigning in an independence referendum.
And bringing it right back just finally to that modern studies. Ruth Davidson was inspired by her modern studies teacher to go into politics. I was inspired in my line of work by my modern studies teacher, John McTaggart, at Inverkeithing High School. Are young people engaged in politics? Are they sitting in your higher modern studies class just to get the qualification? Are they really into it, engaged in Scotland's future, whichever way that might turn out?
Yes, that's also really fascinating. And when we look at the electoral performances of political parties, we look at voting behaviour and look at why young people vote a certain way, for example. And, you know, when I was a teacher, I taught two different subjects, David. I taught modern studies, which incorporates the democracy side of it. And we also looked at international powers and social inequality. But then the other subject that I also taught was higher politics, which was really the kind of nitty gritty part of politics. And I really did feel as if whilst I was in the classroom, in the number of different class schools that I've taught, amongst all the different year groups, there is a genuine interest into what's happening. And it's reminding young people continually that actually they have that opportunity to make a difference in Scotland and ensure that their voices are heard. And of course, in Scotland, 16-year-olds can vote. So pupils in fourth year are able to vote, which is absolutely fantastic. And they ask questions and they debate amongst themselves and they have a genuine interest.
Adam Kaiser-Javed, thank you so much for being on the Stooshy today.
And that was David McDougall speaking with Adam Kaiser-Javed earlier this week. Now, at the end of last week, the Scottish Government released the latest stats on the number of people who had died as a result of drug abuse. We recorded a special Stooshy podcast speaking to experts about it, which you can still download and listen to. And I would really recommend it because we have spoken to some very intelligent people about the issue, and it has engaged really well with those who have any thoughts on the matter. And really, that should be everyone, because this is an issue, whether we like it or not, that affects every single one of us. Now, the Scottish Government made a statement on Tuesday alongside their coronavirus restriction lifting announcement about how they're going to tackle the issue. There was, of course, another increase in the number of people who died from drugs in 2020, a 5.9% increase, bringing the total to 1,339. Andy, you were doing quite a bit of work this week on comparators between the number of people who died in Scotland and the rest of the UK. Now, we know in general it's more than three times likely to die of a drug death in Scotland than you are anywhere else in the UK, but you worked more closely with figures and areas which might be closer in socioeconomic background to Scotland. What did these reveal?
More
shocking statistics, wasn't there?
Last week's figures really just revealed the extent of the crisis in Scotland. We could compare ourselves to previous years, and it was another record total. On this week, official figures were released a little later in England and Wales, and broken down by regions there, which allowed us to really sort of compare against our nearest neighbours. And it didn't make for good reading at all. If you work out the rate per head of population, there's 252 per million in Scotland, and it's just 50 or so in England and Wales. So it really illustrates the high rate in Scotland across our population. If you look at different parts of England, Scotland's rate is more than two times worse than the worst affected part in England, which is the northeast of England, which takes in Newcastle. You compare it to London, now this may have surprised some people, but Scotland's figures were seven times worse. We've heard lots of statements of intent from the Scottish Government. We've, towards the end of last year, there was ministerial reshuffle with Joe Fitzpatrick on his way out, and the new broom Angela Constance coming in to sort it out. She did announce some ways of trying to tackle with this, called it a national disgrace. But she doesn't have very long, I think, before the kind of the emotional response is going to be kind of it's going to have to be replaced by some action. People are really getting fed up with this stubborn social scandal.
I mean, that's been the thing, hasn't it? It's for a while now, a lot of charities like Favour and a lot of recovery groups have come up with a statement: you keep talking, we keep dying. Mm-hmm. And it has gone up exponentially every year since 2014. And obviously the reasons behind drug abuse and drug addiction are multifaceted. We know that there's lots of causes, but one glaring thing that came out in the statistics is that you're 18 times more likely to die if you live in an area of socioeconomic deprivation. If you live in a worse off area, and that includes, similar like Dundee, you're 18 times more likely to die of drug death in Lochee than you are in Broughty Ferry. And I'm sure there's cities across Scotland where that also rings true. What has been suggested, and what
This is the problem.
How seriously now do you think the government are taking it? You know, because it does look like when we had Nicola Sturgeon saying she took her eye off the ball, they still won a landslide in the election. You know, it's quite a difficult one to try and gauge, you know, just how serious an issue people do take of it, isn't it?
Well, I think some of the problem is that drug addiction, it's not something that people want to talk about. And it's, you know, we're talking about illegal drugs. It's a different kind of thing. They look at alcohol. It was front and centre of policy thinking for quite a long time in the Scottish Parliament. Laws were changed. It's been a health emergency for a long time. And you could see that the focus on alcohol was starting to make a difference. The problem with drugs is that it's not front and centre. It doesn't affect, or at least it's not seen as an issue that affects everyone. So it gets pushed to the back, and then people don't have loud voices when it comes to cuts, for example, or the need for more rehabilitation or the impact on the mental health services. It's been maybe sidelined hard, but it's not had the attention that it deserves. And that's exactly what Nicola Sturgeon was getting at when she said that the Scottish Government may have taken their eye off the ball, a phrase that she tried to sort of pull back from. She didn't mean that doesn't mean they're not doing anything. It's just that they haven't done enough. But yeah, there's only a certain amount of time that they'll be given more leeway under Angela Constance to prove that they are making a difference. And I think that they're also going to start bringing in more frequent reporting on the numbers as well. So, you know, there's not going to be a whole year to wait before we see yet another, you know, awful snapshot. I think it's going to have to become a little bit more front and centre, and that might focus minds, perhaps. There's also the problem of the difference between the UK government and the Scottish government. And there is a horrible tendency among some people to say, well, this is all the fault of drug laws being reserved. But that falls down because the figures in England are better and they have the same drug laws. You can talk about the impact of poverty, and you could blame any government you like on that, but the disparity between different parts of the UK shows that there's still a lot of policy areas where anyone can make a difference if they really choose to do it.
And it is one of those ones we have talked previously about this belief in Scottish exceptionalism, but this is really truly the case where Scotland is exceptional and it is leading the number of drugs deaths and how many people are dying each year and the increase. I mean, you know, there's a whole wad of facts that you could pull out and say this is where we are top of this unwanted league, if you will, and that policy doesn't seem to have matched, or intention doesn't seem to have matched the rate in which everyone's dying. We had a bit of to and fro in the pages of the press and online this week as well between the Prime Minister and the Scottish Government, because one of the things that we want to try in Scotland, or certainly the Scottish Government wants to try, is our drug consumption rooms, or safe consumption rooms, or overdose prevention rooms, or, you know, however you want to describe it. I mean, even 5 years ago, we were calling them shooting galleries, which definitely isn't what we should be calling them. And it's good to see that there has been a sort of about turn on a lot of the language used around drug taking and drug abuse, to try and remove that stigma. And, you know, we've all been guilty of it, much similar to the way we talk about race in this country, as we were talking earlier, is that the people involved haven't had the voice or haven't had the... You talked earlier, Andy, about having the loud enough... being heard, being able to be heard over all the noise in terms of when things were getting cut or when things weren't getting paid enough attention to. Rachel, these drug consumption rooms, different political parties are trying to turn this into a football, and it does seem to be the thing that's being kicked back and forth. How do you think that generally the public would view these areas? Do you think, I mean, in my opinion, when it comes to drug consumption rooms or overdose prevention rooms, as we should call them, I think they should be allowed. I think they should be put up, and I know that there's a chap in Glasgow, Peter Crickett, that has been working with a sort of converted ambulance where people can go there, and the police had originally intended to arrest anyone using. But do you think that would reflect an overall change in the public opinion as to possession of drugs, Rachel, and whether or not, if these things were allowed, it is going to cause, as Boris Johnson, more people to take drugs? Or actually, do you think people are willing to give this a chance because actually we've done little else and we need to try something?
Yeah, Angela Constance previously has said that she would like to see drug consumption rooms and things like drug checking facilities introduced to Scotland, and has sort of said the excuse is that these things are reserved to Westminster. I don't think it would encourage more people to take drugs. I don't think anyone sets out to become addicted to these substances. But it would change a lot of things in Scotland, and something does need to change because the way things are working right now, it's not working. We can quite clearly see that. So potentially something like this, it's quite radical, it's quite different. It might cause a lot of people upset, but I think something drastic does need to be done to fix this. So perhaps that is the answer. It also then does sort of go into, is it seen as a justice issue or a health issue? And that's another problem that we have at the moment in Scotland. Where does it fall? Previously, I spoke to Mercedes Villalba. She's the Labour MSP for the North East. She's in support of that. But one of the things she also mentioned is perhaps Scotland should look at decriminalising drugs and see what the benefits of that could potentially be. That happened in Portugal, and once they introduced the decriminalisation of drugs, drug deaths did go down, drug-related crime went down, and rates of HIV and hepatitis infection also went down. So maybe something like that is something that Scotland and the government could look at for inspiration.
And Andy, how important is it this doesn't just become another constitutional argument? Which, you know, it seems that they weren't released this time last year, obviously, because of the coronavirus. But August, I mean, you can go back in our archive back to 2012, 2010, or as far back as you like, and see that the first week in August, there's the drug death statistics come out, and every year it gets worse. And every year, there seems to be the battle line drawn up the week after, which falls down Scotland's usual constitutional lines. How important is it that we don't fall into that same trap with this issue?
Well, yeah, it's that's the trap in almost every contentious debate in Scotland. And of course, there should be room to talk about what various levels of government are doing and whether it's the right thing to do. I think if you look at what Boris Johnson said on this issue of drug consumption rooms, He just says he's instinctively opposed, which in very Boris Johnson way, it sounds like he's making his mind up without really looking at any evidence to suggest whether his instincts are right or wrong. And if he just continues to take that kind of an approach, well, then you can bet that the SNP will then just start shouting about how they need to have the power, because it's not, there's no discussion, there's no sensible discussion going between the two sides. It's really important that they recognise how importantly this is being taken by everybody else. The people who are, like you said earlier, standing up saying, you keep talking, we keep dying. The constitutional football on this issue was worse around, you know, a year or two ago. Well, before the pandemic, certainly, when a lot of the focus was on decriminalisation. But I think the Scottish Government have had to recognise that they can't just say, we need more powers, because since then, there's been a lot more focus on perhaps the funding that they have been in charge of themselves, whether that's to do with treatment, rehab, mental health. And they have had to announce funding to invest heavily in that area, which they've had power already. Their critics point out that really they're just undoing the damage that they presided over. So it's very important that we can see the signs that they're taking the policy part seriously where they are. And it's also, I think it, the Conservative government in Westminster will also have to show that they are taking seriously the calls for a fresh look at drug laws, and it's not just a tug of war over a second independence referendum, which has kind of slipped off the radar a little bit since the May election, for sure.
It's not a vote winner and it's not a vote loser, as a number of the MSPs that returned in May proved. It certainly doesn't set the heather alight when it comes to people reading the stories about it either. But I am going to say that drugs death should be one of the most defining issues of the Scottish Parliament and of the devolution era. And the sooner and the more efficiently it is fixed and sorted, the better that we can reflect on ourselves as a country, devolved, reserved, or other as we can. Now, the Prime Minister made one of his very rare sojourns up to Scotland this week, and it's safe to say that we all got, at least 3 hours chat with him. Lots of interviews. He was very open to the public, and he spoke at great length to the assembled press. Sorry, that was one of my rare jokes. It was the complete opposite. He deigned us with 20 minutes with a dodgy Wi-Fi connection so that we could have a Zoom call while he was out on a boat in the middle of the Murray Firth. And it was just another typical Boris visit. He, halfway through talking about the oil and gas transition, decided to say that Margaret Thatcher's closing of the coal mines was good for environmentalism and set us ahead of the rest of Europe. He wouldn't be drawn as to whether or not he would oppose a second referendum on independence. And as we mentioned earlier, he said that any safe consumption rooms for drug users would encourage drug takers to take even more drugs. Quite a lot to choose from, Andy, and not all the time in the world to talk about it, but another Boris visit, another time for Scottish Tory MPs to stick their heads in their hands and say, what are you doing, man? Yeah. How are you helping in any way, shape or form by being here?
Yeah, the silence from the Scottish Conservative corner was deafening after the latest pronouncement on Margaret Thatcher and how she helpfully kick-started the end of the fossil fuel industries in Scotland. Outside the northeast, Fife in particular, this kind of message about how there's a bit of a positive spin on what the Conservative policies were in the 1980s, that just went down like a slap in the face, really. And in the northeast, Rannabreen, which let's say avoided that just by the fact that the oil boom came along and the end of the coal industry didn't have the same economic impact. The idea that they will now be listening to this message thinking, oh good, we're going to have a rapid winding down of an industry with what to replace it. I spoke to Keir Starmer, for example, this week. He was also up in Scotland. He wants a hard-edged end to oil extraction, and lots of calls for strategies and renewables and lots of high-earning jobs. But anyone who works in that sector is still waiting for a full plan of exactly what it is that's going to replace this industry. And of course, the risk is that it just goes the same way as what happened in coal mining. It just ends, and then we all saw what happened. The devastation socially, poverty, just communities left to fend for themselves, really.
Now, I got the chance to ask the question what the UK government and what Prime Minister was going to do to stop post-industrial decline, which I think anyone that's lived in Scotland for more than 5 minutes can see that there are huge areas, including Dundee, as you mentioned earlier, Fife, the old coal mining areas, Glasgow, where heavy industry and things like coal mining were sort of abruptly stopped and there was nothing to replace it. And it shattered communities, and a lot of MPs from across the political spectrum have agreed with that, and they said that regardless of whether or not Mr. Johnson was joking about Maggie closing the mines and that being good for environmentalism, he didn't answer the question. And you know, Aberdeen, I feel if you're in the oil and gas industry, and everyone who works in Aberdeen and lives in Aberdeen knows someone connected to the oil and gas industry, it must be quite worrying being told, oh, you'll have jobs in renewables as well. Because it's worth pointing out as well that the Moray East wind turbine farm that he was bussed out to, or boated out to, I should say, he was taken on a boat called the Alba, of all things. The wind turbines were made in Denmark. The cables were awarded, the contracts to lay the cables were awarded to, I think, a Dutch company. The infrastructure for the jackets was awarded to a French company and built in France. And there was a Belgian company involved and overseen the whole thing as well. So we already know that renewables jobs are all actually being given elsewhere in the world. We had Bifab in Fife, which was supposed to be building the jackets for wind turbines, is closed and had to be rescued and nationalised. And then again, it seems to be missing out on contracts where we now bring turbines or jackets over for these wind turbines from Korea or anywhere else in the world. And, you know, there seems to be no suggestion that the Prime Minister was going to make sure that renewables jobs and these promised green industries, much like the Scottish government, were going to be protected, or that the Scottish and UK companies were going to be first. So left wing or right wing, and regardless of what you think about whether Maggie shutting the pits caused the end of civilization in the 80s, there's a real worry, and there will be a real worry, as to where people are going to work and what industry people are going to work in once we've decided that we don't want oil anymore. Rachel, what are your thoughts on that? You've worked quite hard on environmental issues and a lot of the sort of quite worrying prophecies of what's going to happen, climate dooming catastrophe. How important is it that we do actually end our reliance on fossil fuels?
Yeah, I think we can all see the weather in recent weeks, not just here in Scotland and the UK, but all across the world. There's been some very worrying weather patterns happening. And a lot of these sort of climate change campaigners are saying this is the climate change happening now. It's now on our doorstep. It's now a very immediate problem. So it is something that we sort of need to look at very carefully as well. A lot of MSPs are calling for moves to electric cars, for example. The Greens, they're wanting it done within the next few years, which is very soon. So that's something we could see a very quick turnaround on. But it is important to make sure those who are working in the fossil fuel industry have something there, because I used to live in Aberdeen, and everywhere you looked, it was oil and gas companies, oil and gas offices. Everyone you met worked in the industry or knew someone in their family who worked in the industry. Even just getting off the train at Aberdeen station, the adverts are all for oil and gas. It's completely apparent just how much that entire city, the entire northeast region, really relies on that industry. So there does need to be something in place where we are not producing as much oil and gas as we are now, but also not failing the people who are working in that industry.
But I think that's all we have time for this week. Thank you to Andy Phillip and Rachel Amory, producers Chris and Morvan, and of course to you for listening. We'll be back next week with more, but until then, and even after, pick up or log on to the Good Air, the Press and Journal, and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed. Bye.
The Stooshie is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stooshie today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stooshie or follow Stooshie Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe. Or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.